Amala quien se abandam ganucaría su
sinuetisna. 66. Raven, Hero says, let me tell you a story before I kill you.
I'll listen, Raven says. It's a long ride.
All vehicles in the metaverse have voice phones on them. Hero simply called home to the librarian and had him look up Raven's number. They are riding in lockstep across the black surface of the imaginary planet now, though Hero is gaining on Raven, meter by meter.
My dad was in the army in World War II. Lied about his age to get in. They put him in the Pacific doing scut work. Anyway, he got captured by the Nipponese.
So they took him back to Nippon, put him in a prison camp. There were a lot of Americans there, plus some Brits and some Chinese, and a couple of guys that they couldn't place. They looked like Indians, spoke a little English, but they spoke Russian even better.
They were Aleuts, Raven says. American citizens. But no one had ever heard of them. Most people don't know that the Japanese conquered American territory during the war. Several islands at the end of the Aleutian chain, inhabited by my people. They took the two most important Aleuts and put them in prison camps in Japan. One of them was the mayor of Atu, the most important civil authority. The other was even more important to us. He was the chief harpooner of the Aleut nation.
Hero says, the mayor got sick and died. He didn't have any immunities, but the harpooner was one tough son of a bitch. He got sick a few times, but he survived. Went out to work in the fields along with the rest of the prisoners, growing food for the war effort. Worked in the kitchen preparing slop for the prisoners and the guards. He kept to himself a lot. Everyone avoided him because he smelled terrible. His bed stank up the barracks.
He was cooking up aconite whale poison from mushrooms and other substances that he found in the fields and secreted in his clothing, Raven says.
Besides, Hero continues, they were pissed at him because he broke out a window pane in the barracks once, and it let cold air in for the rest of the winter. Anyway, one day after lunch, all the guards became terribly sick.
Whale poison in the fish stew, Raven says.
The prisoners were already out working in the fields, and when the guards began to get sick, they began to march them all back in toward the barracks, because they couldn't keep watch over them when they were doubled over with stomach cramps. And this late in the war, it wasn't easy to bring in reinforcements. My father was last in the line of prisoners, and this Aleut guy was right in front of him.
Raven says, as the prisoners were crossing an irrigation ditch, the Aleut dove into the water and disappeared.
My father didn't know what to do, Hero says, until he heard a grunt from the guard who was bringing up the rear. He turned around and saw that this guard had a bamboo spear stuck all the way through his body, just came out of nowhere, and he still couldn't see the Aleut. Then another guard went down with his throat slit. And there was the Aleut, winding up and throwing another spear that brought down yet another guard.
He had been making harpoons and hiding them under the water in the irrigation ditches, Raven says.
Then my father realized, Hero continues, that he was doomed. Because no matter what he said to the guards, they would consider him to have been part of an escape attempt, and they would bring a sword and lop his head off. So, figuring that he might as well bring down a few of the enemy before they got to him, he took the gun from the first guard who had been hit, jumped down into the cover of the irrigation ditch, and shot another couple of guards who were coming over to investigate. Raven says,
the Aleut ran for the border fence, which was a flimsy bamboo thing. There was supposedly a minefield there, but he ran straight across it with no trouble. Either he was lucky, or else the mines, if there were any, were few and far between.
They didn't bother to have strict perimeter security, Hero says, because Japan is an island. So even if someone escaped, where could they run to?
An Aleut could do it, though, Raven says. He could go to the nearest coastline and build himself a kayak. He could take to the open water and make his way up the coastline of Japan, then surf from one island to the next, all the way back to the Aleutians.
Right, Hiro says, which is the only part of the story that I never understood, until I saw you on the open water, outrunning a speedboat in your kayak. Then I put it all together. Your father wasn't crazy. He had a perfectly good plan.
Yes, but your father didn't understand it.
My father ran in your father's footsteps across the minefield.
They were free, in Nippon.
Your father started heading downhill toward the ocean. My father wanted to head uphill into the mountains, figuring that they could maybe live in an isolated place until the war was over.
It was a stupid idea, Raven says. Japan is heavily populated. There is no place where they could have gone unnoticed.
My father didn't even know what a kayak was.
Ignorance is no excuse, Raven says.
They're arguing. The same argument we're having now was their downfall. The Nipponese caught up with them on a road just outside of Nagasaki. They didn't even have handcuffs, so they tied their hands behind their backs with bootlaces and made them kneel on the road facing each other. Then the lieutenant took his sword out of its sheath. It was an ancient sword. The lieutenant was from a proud family of samurai, and the only reason he was on this home front detail was that he had nearly had one leg blown off earlier in the war. He raised the sword up above my father's head.
It made a high ringing sound in the air, Raven says, that hurt my father's ears. But it never came down. My father saw your father's skeleton kneeling in front of him. That was the last thing he ever saw.
My father was facing away from Nagasaki, Hiro says. He was temporarily blinded by the light. He fell forward and pressed his face into the ground to get the terrible light out of his eyes. Then everything was back to normal again.
Except my father was blind, Raven says. He could only listen to your father fighting the lieutenant.
It was a half-blind, one-legged samurai with a katana versus a big, strong, healthy man with his arms tied behind his back, Hiro says. A pretty interesting fight. A pretty fair one. My father won, and that was the end of the war. The occupation troops got there a couple of weeks later. My father went home and kicked around for a while, and finally had a kid during the 70s.
So did yours.
Raven says,
I'm Chitka, 1972. My father got nuked twice by you bastards.
I understand the depth of your feelings, Hiro says. But don't you think you've had enough revenge?
There's no such thing as enough, Raven says.
Hiro guns his motorcycle forward and closes on Raven, swinging his katana. But Raven reaches back, watching him in the rearview mirror, and blocks the blow. He's carrying a big, long knife in one hand. Then Raven cuts his speed down to almost nothing and dives in between a couple of the stanchions. Hiro overshoots him, slows down too much, and gets a glimpse of Raven screaming past him on the other side of the monorail. By the time he's accelerated and cut through another gap, Raven has already slalomed over to the other side. And so it goes. They run down the length of the street in an interlacing zigzag pattern, cutting back and forth under the monorail. The game is a simple one. All Raven has to do is make Hiro run into a stanchion. Hiro will come to a stop for a moment. By that time, Raven will be gone, out of visual range, and Hiro will have no way to track him. It's an easier game for Raven than for Hiro. But Hiro's better at this kind of thing than Raven is. That makes it a pretty even match. They slalom down the monorail track at speeds from 60 to 60,000 miles per hour. All around them, low-slung commercial developments and high-tech labs and amusement parks sprawl off into the darkness. Downtown is before them, as high and bright as the Aurora Borealis rising from the black water of the Bering Sea.